Okay, we'll start with a little quiz. If I was to ask you, what is 55%? I'd give you a little clue. It is in relation to a very recent piece of research. In fact, it was just published last week, concerning contemporary Scotland. It's one of those back-to-front quizzes. You get the answer, and you've got to work out what the question is. Turn to the neighbour. You've got a minute, no more. 55% of what or who in Scotland today? What do you think? The research was a very extensive piece of research conducted among thousands of Scots today, 16 years and above, published last week in the Sunday Times and in various other media outlets. 55%, that is the proportion of people in Scotland today who consider themselves to be Christians. Now, in a sense, that figure is kind of meaningless on its own. You might ask, well, compared to what? Okay, I'll tell you. 10 years ago, that figure was 50%. 10 years ago. Only 10 years ago, my point is, that figure was 70%. Now, maybe you think, well, hey, what's 15% among friends? Any statistician will tell you that in a national populace, a change of 15% in only 10 years is dramatic. A dramatic change, a sea change. Now, if you were also able to plot the figures for the 10 years before that and that again, you would see that we are on a very steep decline. Among the population of Scotland today who considers themselves to be Christian. This should be alarming for any of us who think that it matters. I do. I don't want to imagine what our country will be without a strong Christian influence. Well, maybe we could actually say we can see in part what our country will be like without a strong Christian influence. But if this trend is to continue, and if we're to come back in 10 years' time and find that that number is less than half, then I need to think what our country will be like as fewer and fewer people align themselves with Christian truths and values, and as fewer and fewer people see that the Christian way has to have some bearing on our nation. But folks, even within these figures, there are greater still concerns as far as I can see. The first one is this: of the 55% who see themselves as Christian, by far and away the majority of those are older women. Now, let me clarify, that's not a problem in itself. Long live older women, as far as I'm concerned. In many ways, you're at the heart of churches across the land. In many ways, you older women are at the heart of our nation. As mothers and as grandmothers, you are so often the glue that keeps families together. You make our society what it is, so long live older women. But the problem is the other side of that. By far and away, the weakest response to the question about considering yourselves Christian is among the young. In other words, it's kind of bad now, but it's insulated by older generations. We're kind of declining like that, but potentially the decline may go like that. Unless we can do something to reverse the trend. It's not rocket science what I've just said. Go from church to church across Scotland and you will see that younger people are by far away in the minority. That's why our work over the last 2 weeks was so vital and will continue to be more so as we go from here. It's not enough for us just to say, oh, isn't it terrible nowadays that children aren't brought to church? That won't do. We need to be creative and adventurous and daring to make the church relevant again for those generations. There are still other problems within these statistics I want to share with you. The first one is this. 55% would be wonderful, actually, if that represented committed Christians. It doesn't. The 55% is a very nominal figure. And all of those people who said that they consider themselves to be Christians, wait for this, less than a third of them reported having been in a church in the last year. So in other words, the 55% actually is a bit of a joke. It's made up of a whole bunch of people who are never near a church. And the second other main problem that I want to identify that came out in this research just published, well, it begins with another percentage. This one, in my view, is as worrying as anything else that I've described this morning. So we've got these 55% of people who consider themselves Christian. But of that group, almost one in four don't even actually believe that Jesus was real. They've got him in the same category as Little Red Riding Hood, legend and myth and such like. So even of those who call themselves Christian and are around churches, even if loosely, there is a massive deficit in terms of belief. That's a serious problem. A minister friend of mine exampled this recently. I admit an extreme example, but nonetheless worrisome. Minister went to a member of the church. They were really looking to recruit new elders for the church. And the minister went to this particular person who was in church every Sunday, who had served on the congregational board of the church, who was active in every activity of the church, really recommended themselves to look at as someone who would make an elder. So the approach was made, would you be an elder? And this person said, "Oh no, no, it wouldn't be suitable. I'm a Buddhist." That's what she said. "I don't believe in Jesus. I just love church. I just love being around the coffee and so on." That's problematic. Now, see, that person is an extreme example. But the more worrying trend, as I said, is this, that nearly 25% of those who call themselves Christians don't actually believe that Jesus is real. This displays a lack of confidence in the truth of the gospel and, forgive me, a huge ignorance, even among those who come around church, a huge ignorance. My point is this: Jesus was real, historical fact. What are folk getting at by not believing that Jesus was real? That's the same as saying, "I don't believe Julius Caesar was real." It's the same as saying anybody before the times of cameras and films, "Well, we have got a picture of them, therefore they're not real." How do we know that anybody was real who lived long ago? Does anybody doubt that Julius Caesar lived? No, of course not. He was a historical figure. We've got records for that. But here's the bit you need to get. There are more historical records. There is more evidence that Jesus Christ lived than any other figure from history. So when people say, "Well, I don't actually believe that Jesus was real," it's ignorance. It's historical fact. Even your Richard Dawkins and your most ardent atheists don't deny that Jesus was real. So can we please put that into bed right at the beginning? Jesus was real, and that is evidence. But there's something else that matters more, or every bit as much. We can certainly say Jesus was real, but here's my question: can you say Jesus is real? There is no doubt and no debate about the historical truth that a man called Jesus lived and was crucified by the Romans. Fact. Not for debating. But what about the present tense? Can you say Jesus is real? If the answer to that is no, then last Sunday here in church was a farce. We were deluding ourselves, we were kidding ourselves on, and we would have been better not here. If the resurrection is made up fiction rather than fact, then we cannot say that Jesus is real. And here, of course, we find ourselves standing alongside Thomas. One of the 12, Thomas. As it tells us in John's Gospel, he was not there on the night of the resurrection when Jesus first appeared, risen to the other disciples. Thomas was not there. I wish I knew why. That's one of those little bits of information that the Gospel writers don't give us. I wish I knew why. Was there something good on TV? Was he having a bath before work the next day? Why wasn't he with the others? you'll never know what you might miss when you are not with the others. I mean by that church. Well, whatever the reason was, Thomas was not there. So the other disciples had to tell him, "We've seen the Lord." Thomas was unconvinced. And essentially said, "Unless I see for myself, I won't believe." Now, Thomas was unique in all of history as being the only person who got to touch the risen Jesus. That stands out from everyone else. He was privileged indeed. We don't have that opportunity. So for us, of course, it will be a matter of faith, but not blind faith. And I want to go on to say a word about this. We're not asking, those of us who encourage Christian belief, we're not asking for blind faith. Blind faith is no faith at all, really. I always knew that one day my love of punk music in my teenage years would come in handy. And so it did for this sermon, as I remember this great line: "Blind acceptance is a sign of stupid fools who stand in line." I'm not looking for anything to be stupid fools. No. What you have to do is consider the evidence. You were not there, so you don't know for sure. So instead, you have to consider the evidence, just as a jury does in a court of law. And in the end, after considering the evidence, you have to come to a decision, as a jury does. You don't know beyond, well, you don't know for a fact, but you can come to a point where you know beyond reasonable doubt. I'm much interested by two lawyers. One from some considerable time ago, Simon Greenleaf, who was a law professor at Harvard. And then Frank Morrison, who was a British lawyer in the 20th century. Both of them were staunch atheists. And both of them really were out and out to put down the Christian faith. And so both men set out as lawyers, coldly and dispassionately, to examine the evidence as they had it available to them, with the aim of disproving the resurrection, with the aim of debunking the Christian claims of Jesus being alive. They set out with that purpose, and both men were converted to be Christians as a result. Both men set out trying to disprove it, but the more they looked at the evidence, the more they considered what was before them, they ended up being unable to escape from the conclusion that he did rise. Or at least, I can't find any other reasonable explanation. And you, when you've considered all other possibilities, you're left with that one, that he did rise. The point I'm making is this: these guys were not stupid fools blindly accepting. These were thinking men who came at it with the scalpel of a lawyer to go through the evidence and think carefully. I just made up a phrase. Does that make sense? The scalpel of a lawyer? Maybe a doctor, but not a lawyer. Anyway, I'll think of another turn of phrase from next week. What they did was they looked at the evidence as they saw it. They considered the persecution that the early believers were subjected to. by Romans and Jews alike. And yet, despite the persecution, those early Christians, those first Christians, left behind them a flourishing church. Why did the persecution not put an end to the story of Jesus? They considered the possibility that it was a hoax, a well-manufactured hoax. But then they considered this: who would die for something that they knew to be a made-up lie? People have died for lies, but not knowing that they were lies. Wouldn't you, if you were about to be put to your death, knowing that it was made up, that Jesus was alive, who would confess at that moment? But these men, and in time women, gave their lives because they knew that Jesus was alive. The lawyers considered how it is that legends come into being, myths and legends, and by their examination it became clear to them that any legend worth its salt takes centuries to ground itself and take root. And yet within years, within a few short years of the life and death of Jesus, this truth of him being risen was firmly rooted on three continents. Skeptics said, well, maybe the Romans stole the body. But the Jewish authorities stole the body. Don't you think that if that had been the case, and then when the disciples started to say Jesus is alive, that the Romans or the Jewish authorities would just have produced a dead body and said, here he is, dead as a dodo. But they couldn't, because there was no body. And then people talk of mass hallucination. Maybe all these people, all these hundreds of people who claimed to see Jesus risen, maybe they were all under some kind of delusion or hallucination. Maybe some hundreds. Maybe it was all at the same time. But no, it wasn't. It was on numerous occasions that Jesus was encountered alive. And then more and more desperate attempts to explain it. Maybe he really wasn't dead at all. Just hanging there, dozing, having fainted. And then when they brought him down from the cross and laid him in a grave for 3 days, then he seriously came to life again because he wasn't dead at all. If you know anything about the Romans and their method of execution, you'll know they didn't make such mistakes. When you've ruled out all the other possibilities, you're left with one that is worthy of your consideration. And it is that Jesus is alive, that he rose. I say worthy of your consideration, and that's what I mean. Never mind Frank Greenleaf says, Simon Greenleaf and Frank Morrison. So much for learned lawyers. It's you that matters now. They came to that point of concluding. Not only Jesus was real, but Jesus is real. He rose in his line now. Can you say in your heart, Jesus is real? Jesus is alive. That this cross is empty. If so, then it leads to the following. First of all, that you will know peace that otherwise you will never know in your life. The risen Jesus came to his disciples and granted them his peace in their hearts. And if he's alive, then he's still in the same business and doing the same thing and still coming to those who believe in him and granting them his peace in their hearts. Is that for you? And he grants us his joy, which is to know that he is alive. Joy be much more than happiness. As we've said in this place before, happiness comes and goes depending on the circumstances of your life. Joy is much deeper and cannot be affected by what's going on in your life from day to day. The disciples were overjoyed. Will you be full of joy in your life? It comes from knowing that Jesus rose. And finally, will you be blessed? Blessed are those who have not seen yet have believed. That would be you. You were not there. You did not see for yourselves. But will you believe that he rose and that he is alive? And if so, then you will be blessed. And that blessing is really a combination of the first two, of the peace and the joy. In 21st century Scotland, where less and less and less people consider themselves to be Christian and have any conviction about Christian truths, will you stand up and say that, yes, I build my life on believing that Jesus is alive, that he died for me and that he rose again? Because as that percentage figure goes down, it will take more and more courage to stand up. And will you? And will you, with our children at the holiday club last week, declare, God's not dead? No, he is alive. Because I feel him in my hands. And I want to serve him with my feet. And love him in my heart. Folks, the 55% that we're starting with today may be, if taken, I think, in the wrong way, a cause for discouragement and depression. I stand here today as one who has never been more excited. Never been more excited about being a Christian and about ministering this good news of Jesus to the world. Don't be depressed by that 55%. Instead, be filled with courage and enthusiasm, and together let us go on in strength, knowing, believing that Jesus is alive. Let's pray.